case you haven't observed it by now, I love the book of Isaiah. Most preachers do, I think. It's sort of the preacher's favorite book in general. It has such a wide range of topics and very powerful emotions and glorious depictions of our God. Everything from fire and brimstone, to the most comforting sorts of words. It's just a magnificent book. It's also huge, 66 chapters. And I've been warning you for some time that it comes in two very easily distinguishable parts. The first part has how many chapters in it?
No,
the whole book falls into two. See, you're digging down into details, which I like to see. But in broader strokes, it's the first 39 chapters. And, of course, we finished chapter 39 last week. So we're about to enter into what is that second of the big sections of the book. There are then, obviously, 39 books in that first part. How many would there be in the second part? 27, which also happens to correlate with how many books we have in the total Bible. I don't believe that there's any direct connection. I mean, to put the chapters into Isaiah, of course, we're not sent by God to do that so that it would match anything. But it is coincidental also, as I pointed out in our introductory information, that in only the broadest sense, there's many exceptions to it, but the first 39 chapters do seem to kind of focus to some extent or to a larger extent on Old Testament themes and times. Now, right off the bat tonight, we're going to look at the next section, and immediately it's Old Testament themes and times. But after a little while, you'll find that this last section is going to have a great deal of information about the coming of the Messiah, about the establishment of His church, a number of themes that are related to the fulfillment of the Old Testament. So, with the largest overview, it roughly falls into these two sections. So if I say, Ahem, what does that stand for? Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, Micah. We put the four together that way because they are all contemporary prophets. So if you take what is thought to be the earliest date for Amos, and then you look at the latest date for Isaiah and Micah, which appears to be essentially identical, you have a span of 765 B.C. to 695 B.C., which then represents one 70-year block of time, which is amazing to think about because you've got four Bible books that are involved in that time. You've got a lot of historical information that's involved in that time. This happens to be an extremely significant seven decades in the history of God's people and in His plans for redemption. So you'll recognize this chart as before. It's much too small to read at this Zoom level, but how many years can anybody remember? I dare you. I'll buy you an ice cream at Dairy Queen tonight if you can tell me how long did the northern 10 tribes survive after they were born in the strife of Rehoboam's foolishness and Jeroboam the son of Nebat's apostasy. How long did they last?
30 years.
That's it. All right. But he didn't say the question is, and so but you're exactly right. So 208 years. And then on the right-hand side over there, the southern kingdom, two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, go by the larger tribe's name, Judah, lasted how long? I'll give you that one. Okay, they lasted for 344 years. Both of those are odd numbers. I know they're hard to remember, but ultimately the southern kingdom lasted 136 years longer than Israel, the northern kingdom, did. And that because what you also notice when you look at just the colors, as we zoom in now on this, what do you notice about the colors? This side never had a good king. This side had a handful of good kings, even more after here. So, they just had better kings and they lasted longer. Ted, yes, hand up. Yeah, what did you use? mean? Because I don't remember. I'll bet it's 586, but I have to check on it. There are three invasions by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, 606, 597, and 586. Because I can give you those three dates, I have redeemed myself in Jim's eyes. But when I counted that at the start of this class, I think I was using 586, because that is when you have the last invasion, the temple is burned to the ground. You know, it really is the end, so I'm pretty sure it'd be 586. Okay, so now let's zoom really in tightly and come to this part right here where we can now see, hopefully most of you, that Amos is right there, Hosea is there, Isaiah is over here, and Mike is over here, because we have in this chart from 780 B.C. to 680 B.C., exactly 100 years, Amos does not preach for a very long time, so you can read his name sideways. Hosea spans about 30 years, and so I turn him sideways there. You know, he covers a couple of the kings. They're over there on the left-hand side because Amos and Hosea are more specifically prophesying to the southern, to the northern kingdom before they're taken into captivity by what country? What year? 722 B.C. 722, right there, Assyrian captivity takes place. But that's also total Assyrian destruction. Do the 10 northern tribes return to ever be again a recognizable nation? No, they do not. But some survive and hide out there. Others come back later, drifting back in. They intermarry with Assyrians and Gentiles that had occupied the land as well. And so they became the Samaritans, the Samaritans. I can't even remember the history now how it came to be, though, that the Samaritans were kind of limited and in the center of Israel. The Galileans were very much, you know, Jews as opposed to Samaritans later. But that's ultimately what takes place. And to this day, there are those who claim to be Samaritans who are still, as a matter of fact, offering animal sacrifice there in the central part of Israel. Here we have Isaiah. And the four kings that he prophesied during that he told us were Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Now, fortunately for Isaiah, what he noticed about the colors of these kings? He's got mostly good guys to deal with. Ahaz is a bum, but the other three, the good guys. Uzziah made some mistakes, some serious mistakes. But on the whole, was a better king. Micah does not preach quite as long as Isaiah does, but these same kings are mentioned. And so we are looking now at, we think, a period of something like 40 to 60 years for Isaiah. Nobody knows for sure. It's rather apparent, certainly, he preached for at least 40 years. You got to if you're going to cover four kings. So it's no matter how you cut it, he had to do 40. How much longer he got into, you know, each of the border kings, you know, I don't know, Isaiah and Hezekiah. So he may have preached as much as 60 years. In Halley's Bible Handbook, which we've recommended so often and so many of you now have purchased, just get them secondhand, you know, at Vinnie's and all that. Halley's Bible Handbook is the recommending, and Halley himself is recommending, that Isaiah preached for 50 years. Now, I never met the man. I have enormous respect for him, but that looks like a safe bet. Because how many years would that be? 50 years. So you get 40 to 60, and he picks 50, so you know we're fine with that. Isaiah probably preached about 50 years. And that being the case, he's going to be personally involved, both before and after the 10 northern kings are taken into captivity, with Assyria. He's going to be warning those 10 tribes. We've been seeing him do that. They're not going to respond. Assyria is going to come in. So in green right here, you can see how they occupied the Fertile Crescent. From the Persian Gulf to the Red Sea, the Mesopotamian region between the two rivers of Tigris and Euphrates, this is the area that they conquered and even got down into Egypt a little bit off, you know, into what would be modern-day Turkey. Just to read for you here, It says the Assyrian Empire reached its peak of power between 880 BC and 612 BC. So they were around for well over 200 years. That's a good long span. 722, Assyria destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel, deporting its people, and subdued Judah, the southern kingdom, though of course never succeeded in capturing the capital city itself. Then you'll see that for all of the prominence that Babylon has in biblical affairs of the Old Testament, is their kingdom larger or smaller than Assyria? Well, it's actually smaller. It's still a superpower, but it's a little more constricted there. The Babylonians took Nineveh, the capital city of Assyria, in 612 BC and beat the Egyptians at Carchemish in 605. Oddly enough, that battle's way up here. It's nowhere near Egypt, but that spells doom for Egypt. Their armies are defeated. And so, 605 BC, Babylon's now got Egypt up there. And in 586, Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem and deported most of the people of Judah. So ended the kingdom of Judah. So as you can see, nominally, he's defeated the Egyptian army, but it's not like he marched in there and sat on the throne or really gave many orders there in the far south. The Babylonian Empire will be followed by the Medo-Persian, we usually say, or Persian Empire on this map. Medo-Persians are going to come in, and they're now bigger than the preceding two, aren't they? That Persian Empire was serious stuff. So, in 539 BC, Cyrus of Persia captured Babylon and took over the empire. Cyrus encouraged his subject peoples to retain their religion and culture. And in 538 BC, the Jews were sent back to Judah to restore Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. That is a major focus for everything we're going to study tonight and at least one more night in the nine chapters, 40 through 48. In those chapters, these events we've just talked about, the collapse of the Assyrians and the rise and then fall of the Babylonians, and especially this man Cyrus, permeates everything that we're going to talk about tonight in chapters 40 through 48. So, the last one I just, or next two actually I threw out for you. While there's not going to be much said about this, you know, the chapters are studied tonight, well, nothing. Just to see the maps now, the Greek Empire, between 513 and 333 BC, the Persians and Greeks struggled for supremacy in the Middle East. Finally, Alexander the Great swept into Persia, conquering all his path, made it all the way up to the Indus River. You see right here, you know, never got into India, but he was on his way when he died in 323 B.C. I think he was only 30 years old or 33, something like that. The huge Greek Empire then was broken up among the four kings. Palestine was ruled by the Seleucid kings. This will be very important to us when we get into Daniel eventually, but here's Israel. Okay, the Greek Empire fell apart when Alexander died, and four of Alexander's generals divvied it up. They then fought among themselves a long time, and eventually two of them came out as equally strong. The Seleucids will take this part to the north. The Ptolemies will take this part to the south. And then the Seleucids and the Ptolemies are going to fight back and forth endlessly, and poor Israel is going to be right in the middle, constantly besieged by these two far superior powers. And then just to finish it up, eventually the Roman Empire, you can see we've zoomed way out now, the Roman Empire, is it going to be larger or smaller than these others? Significantly larger than these others. It doesn't get to be quite the Far East, but it really does, take over all the, completely encompasses Mediterranean Sea and clear off into Britain. So, believe it or not, though, the span of the material that we're looking at tonight, chapters 40 through 48, will reach even into those days. Now, I'm not going to rehearse all of this. We've done it several times. It was helpful while we were here by asking you to try to memorize it. But we've come through these first 39 chapters until we got last week to chapters 36 through 39, which were historical rather than what we think of as prophetic. As a matter of fact, these chapters, 36, 7, 8, and 9, those four, and this one, are of a historical nature. Your mice and me is telling the history of that vision. But all the rest of this is God informing a wide variety of peoples, both Jew and Gentile, about events that they will suffer if they do not repent. There's other information. We saw messianic information. But these five chapters, 36 to 39 and then 6, you know, are the only historical chapters. So when you turn the page to chapter 40, it becomes very apparent that you've got a break. So let's connect, though, what we had and what we're about to have by just remembering what was the last thing we talked about last week. What's the last thing you learn on the last page of the 39th chapter of the first section? What happens? Go ahead, Bill. Absolutely correct, but not far enough down to the end. You're absolutely right. But I was really looking for only verses 6, 7, and 8 at the very end. The very last thing we learn is this. Behold, days are coming when all that is in your house and all your fathers have laid up to this day will be carried to Babylon. Babylon is now here in Isaiah. He's been there before. We've seen the destruction of Babylon in chapters 13 and 14. That was the week that Lenny was teaching. But here's Babylon at the end, and nothing will be left, says the Lord, to Hezekiah about his kingdom. Some of your sons, whom you will beget, will be taken away. They'll become officials in the palace of the king of Babylon. Then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, the word of the Lord which you have spoken is good, for he thought, there will be peace and truth in my days. So he was grateful at least that he was not going to live to see this disaster where Babylon was going to own all of Israel. But the days were coming. This is a predictive prophecy. It is a foretelling of the future. And it closes these first 39 chapters in an historical portrayal that sets Babylon right there prominently as the destroyer of all of Israel. So, Babylon now is going to figure very highly in this section we're looking at tonight. Very, very important. It is destroying Israel, or the last vestiges of the United Kingdom is destroying Judah, you know, at the end of 39, but it's going to be prominently important in these chapters 40 through 48. But in chapters 40 through 48, the first part of the last section of the book, we are also going to deal with prophecy at great length. Get your pencils out tonight, because we're going to attack this section very differently than we normally do. We will also see idolatry described and challenged and even mocked at great length. It's really kind of fun in some places, the way that God very vigorously and sometimes almost humorously is attacking idolatry. And then there'll be a little bit about the coming of Jesus the Christ. That's not very prominent, but it is present. And that in the figure of servants. We're going to have really three servants in the course of our reading. Christ, of course, is a servant of God. Israel is a servant of God. But thanks to this predictive prophecy, there's going to be another servant. That servant I'm going to introduce to you here in just a few minutes. So, Christ becomes the center, really, of everything in 40 through 66 in the last 27 chapters of the book. But not till a little bit later. Not so much in the early going, very much so in the latter part. The idolatry is really pretty easy, and you can cover it very quickly. So I was looking at these chapters and trying to figure the best way, you know, to tackle them. And I thought, well, the idolatry thing, you're familiar with some of these expressions already. Nobody here is tempted to it. You know, we can cover that pretty easily. And Babylon, as I've said, is awfully important. So the four things I introduced a minute ago, though, Babylon is only important in the light of prophecy. What I hope to demonstrate tonight is that while God is talking about Babylon and he's talking about idolatry, he introduces us a little bit to the Messiah. He has, in chapters 40 through 48, really one mission, one purpose, one grand thing that he's trying to accomplish. And that is for him to say, I am Yahweh. That is my name. And there is no other God but me. And when he gets done, you'll believe it. Okay? In these chapters. Because of prophecy. So what I want to do here tonight, and I was telling Jerry about this a little while ago, what I want to do tonight is have you get your pencils out, and instead of reading through it verse by verse like we normally do, what I'm going to have you do is mark every passage that is not only a prophecy, but it's a particular kind of a prophecy. And as we go along, you'll see that this really is the heart of chapters 40 through 48. Everything else radiates off of that hub. So, no more charts. Just going to turn the screen off. Follow with me now. And don't try to hook it all together with context. Because I'm hoping, never presented the material this way, but I think it'll work. If we go and see the main threads, that general theme that is the heart of all of this, then if we get through all these passages tonight, we'll go back to chapter 40 and we'll start reading verse by verse, and then however far we get next week, we'll do the same. I'm hoping that if we go through and look at these highlight milepost passages, we get those anchored firmly in our minds, then we'll say, okay, now let's go back and just read through it. And when we do, likely, it'll make more sense to you. Because often with Isaiah, and certainly it's true in these verses, when you just plunge into it and read it, you can get quite easily confused, just really quickly. And so if we go this other way, take this theme, get that, you know, anchored down, then I think you'll really enjoy this section even more. It's one of my favorite parts of the book. So, the way we're going to start here this evening is to come over to chapter 41. We're going to skip chapter 40 altogether. And then, I want you to look at verses 1 through 4. Chapter 41, verse 1. Coastlands. Well, you saw the picture of the Roman Empire there. This is all the Mediterranean coastlands. And let the peoples listen to me in silence. And let the peoples, that's plural, so that's nations, so that's Gentiles, gain new strength. Let them come forward. Let them speak. Let us come together for judgment. Who has aroused one from the east, whom he calls in righteousness to his feet? He delivers up nations before him and subdues kings. He makes them like dust with his sword, as his wind-driven chaff with his bow. He pursues them, passing on in safety, by a way he had not been traversing with his feet. Who has performed and accomplished it, calling forth the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, that is, I, Yahweh, am the first and the last. I am he. Now, brethren, the first time you read those verses, and maybe even the second, the third, and the fourth time, most people just look at it and say, well, that's it. I'm done. I can understand 36, 37, 38, 39. They make sense to me. But I read that, and I can't even figure out who the pronouns are talking about. They capitalize some of them. They don't capitalize others, and that's just the translator's idea there. Who's the guy coming from the east? Who it is, you know, that's sending him? Who's doing what? What is this about? So I would have you just make, you know, that big kind of parenthesis bracket thing, and then write off on the side, as I have done, predictive prophecy of Cyrus coming to free the Jews from Babylon. Now, if you could see that first time you read it, I truly would be amazed. Because you have to read all 9 chapters to figure that out. It's not apparent right here. You'll see it in a few minutes, but it's not apparent right here. What that is in 1 through 4 is God saying, I'm going to raise up Cyrus. Cyrus is going to defeat Babylon. When that happens, my people are going to be free, because Cyrus is going to be a really powerful guy. And then, just know this in verse 4. Who has performed and accomplished it? Calling forth the generations from the beginning. In other words, talking about generations to come before they're here. It's predictive prophecy. I, Yahweh, am the first, and with the last, I am He. Now, by the way, we've never gotten into this before. I keep pointing out that if you see all capitals, L-O-R-D, that is Yahweh, the word Yahweh. All right. Nobody's sure how to pronounce it. There's a lot of history behind that I am going to skip. But the best we can figure is that Yahweh simultaneously means I was, I am, and I will be. That is God's name. So if I was, I am, and I will be is the name of our God, Yahweh, then in 2 words, He is I am. Okay? Now you'll remember that term and how prominent that term is throughout your Old Testament. The eternal nature of God is the foremost concept in His name. Whenever you see all capitals L-O-R-D, you are seeing my name is, I was, I am, and I will be. I am has spoken to you. The eternal God. Okay? His point here is that He can predict the future. Because He was, and He is, and what else? He will be. And He is these 3 things, what? Simultaneously, because He is an eternal spirit being. Okay? So the thrust of all these passages, as you'll see, is most preeminent above all else that's said. I, Yahweh, predict and make happen the future. Try that on for size. Okay? Now turn the page, in my Bible anyway, and come on down in chapter 41 to verses 21 through 24. Present your case, Yahweh says. Bring forward your strong arguments, the king of Jacob says. Let them bring forth and declare to us what is going to take place. As for the former events, declare what they were, that we may consider them and know their outcome. Or announce to us what is coming. Declare the things that are going to come afterwards, that we may know that you are gods. Indeed, do good or evil, that we may anxiously look about us and fear together. Behold, you are of no account, and your work amounts to nothing. He who chooses you is an abomination. Now, I told you we got several themes tonight. Idolatry is very prominently there. And throughout 40 through 49, there is this great contest going on. This tremendous competition. It is God against idols. And it doesn't matter who he's talking to. It is God against idols. Did the Jews have problems with idolatry? Well, up came this calf. You know, they've had problems with idolatry all along. They've had problems with idolatry. Does the Assyrians practice idolatry? Do they? Sure. Will Babylon? Sure. All the rest of the nations we were talking about? Yes. Idolatry is the order of the day. Funny, I was listening to a Bible class this week on Isaiah. This is one of Lowell Williams' classes, and somebody raised their hand, and they said, "Lowell," you can tell it just hit their heads. They said, "Is there ever a people back in history that were atheists?" Yeah, great question. And you know what the answer is? No. All peoples everywhere worship something. And idolatry usually means a lot of somethings. They invent a whole bunch of gods. That's the way it usually has always been. Atheism, at best, has always been an extremely tiny minority. And their prominence in our culture is to our shame and kind of astonishing. It's still less than 5% of them, you know, in our population, but nonetheless, they're very vocal in all of that. But it's kind of a strange and new sort of a thing for people to think they're so smart that there is no God. Because very brilliant people throughout the ages, you know, never thought that. They just had trouble figuring out what the Creator was, but they truly didn't believe in atheism. So, in these verses 21 through 24, you have this contest, this challenge. He says, "Bring it on! Tell me anything about the future. You idols, tell me anything." See, that's how you don't have tongues and you don't live. Do anything. Do good or do evil. Just do anything. You know, but an idol, what? Just stands there because it's made out of rock or it's made out of, you know, wood, but it's not going to do anything. Now, brethren, in verses 25 through 29, let's just keep reading. "I have aroused one from the north, and he has come. From the rising of the sun, he will call my name, call on my name, and he will come upon rulers as upon mortar, even as the potter treads clay." Now just right in the margin, that's Cyrus. You know how you know that? Because I say so. Let that be enough for you for now. But remember, when we started here, God started in 41 by saying, "Who has aroused one from the east?" Who will come from the east that God arouses? It's Cyrus. He is coming. "Whom he calls in righteousness to his feet. He delivers up nations, subdues kings, makes them like dust with his sword." That was Cyrus. This is Cyrus in verse 25. I'll prove it in a little bit. Take my word for it now. In 26, "Who has declared this from the beginning that we might know? Or from former times that we may say, he's right. Surely there was no one who declared. Surely there was no one who proclaimed. There was no one who heard your words. Formerly I said to Zion, behold, here they are. And in Jerusalem, I'll give a messenger of good news. But when I look, there's no one. There's no counselor among them who, if I ask, can give an answer. Behold, all of them are false. Their works are worthless. Their molten images are wind and emptiness." What are those verses about? Same thing we've already seen twice before. God is saying, "I know everything. I move everything. I dare you to do anything. The chief among it, I'm asking, predict anything." So there's a person coming from the east in chapter 41, the first part of it. Here at the end part of it, in verse 25, he's coming from the north. And from the what? Yeah, because that's where the sun rises. Fertile Crescent, remember when I showed it to you? Now you got a compass. Where's Cyrus in relation to Israel? He's east. And between here and there, what do you got? The whole Arabian Desert. So if you're going to come from the east to Israel, when Israel looks up and sees you coming, where are you coming from? From the north. Comes from the east and the north. Now then, turn over to chapter 43. And we'll take, I know it sounds odd, but we're just going to even skip the first verse. Go to 2 through 7. 2 through 7. "When you pass through the waters, I'll be with you, and through the rivers. They will not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be scorched, nor will the flame burn you. For I am Yahweh, your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. I have given Egypt as your ransom." Cush and Seba in your place. Since you are precious in my sight, honored, and I love you, I will give other men in your place and other peoples in exchange for your life. Do not fear. I am with you. I will bring your offspring from the east. Verse 5. Do not fear. I am with you. I will bring your offspring from where? Well, how did they get over there? We haven't read about that yet. But you know the history. Daniel will tell the history. Nebuchadnezzar comes. Babylonian, you know, invasion. Destroys everything. Takes the people all captive off to Babylon, which is in the east. Because they captured all of Assyria. Your offspring are going to be in the east. And I will gather you from the west. Were they scattered also in other directions? Sure enough. But I'm bringing you home. Then, in 6, I will say to the north, give them up. And to the south, do not hold them back. Bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth. Everyone who is called by my name and whom I have created for my glory, whom I have formed, even whom I have made. Now, brethren, some think that's a messianic prophecy. It could be. In my mind, though, as I look at all 9 of these chapters, which I've been reading the last couple of days, as I'm looking at them, I'm thinking, well, I believe there's one theme here, and it's not the Messiah at that location. But it is a predictive prophecy, as you'll be writing in the margin, of Cyrus ending the Babylonian captivity. It is a predictive prophecy. It is a foretelling of the future that these people will be captured by a country that will completely encircle them. You saw the map. Babylon will be on all 4 sides of Israel. But its capital is in the east. That's where we start. Then we're going to bring these people all back. That captivity of your descendants will come to an end. Chapter 44. In 44, we're going to look at 7 and 8. Just the 2 verses. Who is like me? Let him proclaim and declare it. Yes, let him recount it to me in order. From the time that I established the ancient nation, and let them declare to them the things that are coming and the events that are going to take place. Do not tremble and do not be afraid. Have I not long since announced it to you and declared it? And you are my witnesses. Is there any God besides me? Or is there any rock? I know of none, God says. Well, what is that? It is a challenge to anyone to predict the future. So I wrote that in the margin. Challenge everyone to predict the future. Can anybody do that? No, they can't. Turn the page. Chapter 44, still the last verses, 24 through 28. 24 through 28 in chapter 44 says, Yahweh, your Redeemer, and the one who formed you from the womb, I, the Lord and the Maker of all things, stretching out the heavens by myself, and spreading out the earth all alone, causing the omens of boasters to fail, making fools out of diviners, causing wise men to draw back, and turning their knowledge into foolishness, confirming the word of his servant and performing the purpose of his messengers, it is I who says of Jerusalem, she shall be inhabited. Now wait, stop, think. What king does Isaiah spend personal time with in chapters 36 through 39? Hezekiah. In chapters 36 through 39, talking to King Hezekiah, where's Hezekiah? Is Jerusalem inhabited? Well, then why would you be giving a command that it be inhabited? Because it is predicting a future when there will be no inhabitants of Jerusalem. But I, God, will give the command, and then what? Then there will be. And when does that happen? Under Cyrus, when he sends the Jews back after the 70-year Babylonian captivity. Not only that, of Jerusalem in the middle of verse 26, but, and of the cities of Judah, they shall be built. I'll raise up her ruins. It is I who says, to the depth of the sea be dried up. I'll make your rivers dry. It is I who says of what? Cyrus. He is my shepherd, and he will perform all my desire. And he declares of Jerusalem, she will be built. And of the temple, your foundation will be laid. Now, right then and there, what did Isaiah just do? He preached even for 60 years. He's going to die maybe 690, 680 B.C. When will the Jews come back from Babylonian captivity? 536 B.C. Cyrus won't be born for at least 100 years, perhaps 150. And what did Isaiah just do? Named him. And tells you what he's going to do. He's going to give commands to inhabit Jerusalem. He's going to give commands to build that temple. Now that's a predictive prophecy, isn't it? So we have, what I wrote in my margin was, God alone can foretell the future. And he's not done with Cyrus. Look at verses 1 through 7 in chapter 45. Thus says the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed, whom I have taken by the right hand to subdue nations before him and to loose the loins of kings, to open doors before him so that gates will not be shut. I will go before you and make the rough places smooth. I'll shatter the doors of bronze and cut through the iron bars. Then I'll give you the treasures of darkness and hidden wealth of secret places in order that you may know that it is I, Yahweh. What's Yahweh mean? I was, I am, I will be. It is I, the God of Israel, who calls you by your name. For the sake of Jacob my servant and Israel my chosen one, I have also called you by your name. I've given you a title of honor, though you've not known me. I am Yahweh, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. I will gird you, though you have not known me, that men may know from the rising to the setting of the sun, you saw the extent of those empires, that there is no one besides me. I am Yahweh, and there is no other. The one, forming light and creating darkness, causing well-being and creating calamity, I am Yahweh who does all these. Now, brethren, part of what Hezekiah was told was that when your descendants go into captivity after you're dead and gone, they will be what in Babylon? Officials in Babylon. Okay? Well, Daniel had how many friends? What were they in Babylon? Officials in Babylon. Hundred some odd years later. Okay? So, 7 years captivity, but this is well before that. We've got a 100-year span here. He is predicting everything that's going to happen. Now, suppose that Cyrus moves in on Babylon, he conquers the capital city, and what does that give him right off the bat? A library card. What does he now have access to? All records of the kingdom. Who are some of his highest officials in that kingdom? Daniel's one of them. He knew the time had come, read it in Jeremiah, didn't he? You know Daniel's book. Okay? Could Daniel hand a copy of Isaiah to Cyrus? And if he did, what would Cyrus find in there in chapter 44 and 45? Well, look here. That's my name. Where did you get this, Isaiah? Oh, we've had it in our records for 100 years. You have? Yeah. Hey, we've known about you for 100 years. Could that conversation have taken place? Well, sure it could. Okay. So, when he says, I am doing this, verse 6, that men may know from the rising to the setting of the sun that there's no one besides me, I am, I was, I will be, and there is no other. Okay? There's a record, a non-biblical record, of Alexander the Great bumping into the Jews and thinking that he is written in their works, in their books. This same thing is going to happen for Titus when Josephus is going to tell him that he's going to conquer Jerusalem. All the, you know, come 70 AD. These books have always been around, and they've been predicting these things ahead of the fact. Look at verses 11 through 13 in chapter 45. Thus says Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel and his Maker, ask me about the things to come concerning my sons, and you shall commit to me the work of my hands. It is I who made the earth and created man upon it. I stretched out the heavens with my hands, and I ordained all their hosts. I have aroused him in righteousness, and I will make all his ways smooth. He will build my city and will let my exiles go free without any payment or reward, says Yahweh of hosts. So I wrote in the margin, God foretells the future coming of Cyrus. Did Cyrus do all those things? And who bought the right to leave Cyrus's kingdom and go back and build a temple in Jerusalem? Who paid for the trip? Cyrus did. Okay. How specific can you get 100 to 150 years before the event? Chapter 45, verses 21 through 24. Declare and set forth your case. Indeed, let them consult together. Who has announced this from old? Who has long since declared it? Is it not I, Yahweh? And there is no other God besides me, a righteous God and a Savior. There is none except me. Turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God, and there is no other. I have sworn by myself. The word has gone forth from my mouth in righteousness and will not turn back, that to me every knee will bow, every tongue will swear allegiance. They will say of me, only in Yahweh are righteousness and strength. Men will come to him, and all who are angry at him shall be put to shame. In the Lord, all the offspring of Israel will be justified and will glory. Now, brethren, I think surely there are messianic overtones looking all that way into the future there. But what is still the point? I predicted, I make it happen just like I made everything else in the universe. Chapter 46, verses 8 through 11. Remember this and be assured. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things long past. For I am God, and there is no other. God, and there is no one like me. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure, calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country. Who is the man of his purpose? Cyrus, king of Persia. Thus I have spoken, thus I will bring it to pass. I have planned it, I will do it. So I wrote in the margin, God alone can foretell the future. And he's talking about Cyrus since chapter 41. Okay, we have three more. At the end of chapter 47, we're going to look at just verse 13. You are worried with your many counsels. Let now the astrologers, those who prophesy by the stars, those who predict by the new moons, stand up and save you from what will come upon you. Well, again, we're looking to the future. Let's see those guys help you with the future. Can't be done. Next is 48, verses 12 through 16. Listen to me, O Jacob, even Israel, whom I called. I am he. I am the first. I am also the last. Brother, what is that verse doing? It is describing Yahweh. See, there's his names. Surely my hand founded the earth and my right hand spread out the heavens. When I call to them, they stand together. Assemble all of you and listen. Who among them has declared these things? Yahweh loves him. He shall carry out his good pleasure on Babylon and his arm against the Chaldeans. Who's going to do that? Cyrus is going to do that. The Lord loves Cyrus. He'll carry out, Cyrus will, his good pleasure on Babylon. Cyrus's arm will be against the Chaldeans. But will not God's arm also be against the Chaldeans? Yeah, the whole point is, who raises up Cyrus? And tells it from the beginning, 150 years early, I, God. So in 15, I, even I, have spoken. Indeed, I have called him. I have brought him. He will make his way successful. Come near to me. Listen to this. From the first, I have not spoken in secret. From the time it took place, I was there. And now the Lord Yahweh has sent me and his Spirit. That is a predictive prophecy of Cyrus. Now, you'll note, I was disagreeing with some of the capitalization in that passage, wasn't I? Capitalization is not in the original. I'm taking some of those capital H's to refer to Cyrus. So you've blocked the verses, you've made a note, you go back and think about it. It actually kind of works both ways, since God is sending Cyrus and then Cyrus is doing what God wants, but I think most of it points more directly at Cyrus himself. Last one, the end of the first section of the last part of the book. Chapter 48, verses 20 through 22, this section ends like this. Go forth from Babylon. Flee from the Chaldeans. Declare with the sound of joyful shouting. Proclaim this. Send it out to the end of the earth. Say, Yahweh has redeemed his servant Jacob. And they did not thirst when he led them through the deserts. He made the water flow out of the rock for them. He split the rock and the water gushed forth. There is no peace for the wicked, says Yahweh. End session. Okay? So, brethren, what do we have in all those passages? God is just throwing down the gauntlet. You idolaters, you false prophets, you Jews, you Gentiles, I've taken all of you on. I've given you details. Okay? What will be? Now tell me one thing you know about next week. Okay? Now, you got all the stitching. If you go read chapters 40 through 48 now this next week, I think it'll make more sense to you. And starting next week, we're going to spend a lot more time just reading straight through. And you'll see some themes that are being developed. But they are all hung on the gargantuan tree trunk of what? Yahweh. I was, I am, I will be. And I've been telling you about the future for centuries, haven't I? Class dismissed.